Yeah, thank you very much, first of all, for the invitation and for the opportunity right at the beginning of my stay for about 2.5 weeks to present our recent data belonging to a series of investigation devoted to shed light on the impact of a so-called electronic pneumatic phase in iron-based superconductors, particularly from the perspective of the optical response of the electrodynamic response. So what you do see here, someone was claiming it's a fake picture, but it's a true building. This is the main building of our school in Zurich in downtown area, although the campus where physics is done is outside on the hill on the north side of the town. So this is the lake is on that side, and downtown Zurich is actually behind the building itself. Okay, so just to tell you what is about here. First of all, I would like to introduce the topic of my presentation, which will be somehow focused on recent data, which are yet unpublished on iron-selenium compound. The work is still in progress, particularly as far as the analysis is concerned, but I think we already have a quite complete set of results, which allows me, hopefully, to tell you an interesting story about nematicity in iron-based superconductors, and whenever possible and time permitting, I would like also to establish a link with our early data on the cobalt-doped 1-2 materials. Now, let me first of all briefly introduce the topic of my presentation with a concept which certainly in this community are pretty well known, but the main goal is somehow to set the stage for the motivation of our recent investigation on iron and selenium. So it is well known, certainly, that superconductivity, particularly at high temperature, seems to emerge in the proximity of a broken symmetry state, and the pneumatic phase advances as a key concept recently, particularly also with some relevance as far as the pairing mechanism is concerned. And in fact, the revival of nematicity occurred at the time of the discovery of broken symmetry competing state in the pseudo-gap phase of the high-temperature superconducting cuprates, but the iron-based superconductors provide the most recent playground in order to look to this interesting state of matter. And in fact, in these iron-based superconductors, there's a structure, tetragonal to orthorhombic phase transition, which breaks the four rotational symmetry of the tetragonal phase, and this was ascribed to an electronic pneumatic phase itself. And the way experimentally you observe pneumaticity is through laser anisotropic physical properties in almost all possible measurable quantities. The anisotropy is so large, is so important, goes behind actually what you may expect from the simple orthorhombic distortion itself. So, and I like introducing the topic of my presentation to recall this set of data, which provide one of the very first evidence for nematicity here in the cobalt-doped 1-2 materials. What you do see here in a phase diagram-like representation, so temperature versus doping, is the so-called DC anisotropy, represented by the ratio of the resistivity along the orthorhombic shorter B-axis. This is the convention with respect to the resistivity along the orthorhombic elongated A-axis. And you see that the anisotropy is non-monotonic with doping. It's particularly important at the onset of the superconducting dome indeed. And the anisotropy is relevant if you think that the orthorhombicity itself is much less than 1% at low temperature. Now, the point that I would like to make here or to emphasize is that this anisotropy start to develop a temperature above the critical temperature for the structural tetragonal to orthorhombic phase transition. This was ascribed to a substantial pneumatic susceptibility, which was also evinced experimentally with a very elegant elastoresistive type of investigation using a piezo technique. Now, there's another aspect that is also somehow indicated here that the structural phase transition in almost all iron pnictite and chalcogenides materials, particularly as far as the underdog regime is concerned, is a coincident or eventually precedes the phase transition into a broken symmetry state due to a magnetic ordering, usually because of the development of a spin density wave condensate. So it is believed that nematicity itself is very much intertwined with the magnetic ordering, and therefore in this particular example or materials, it's not really possible to look for the genuine impact of the pure nematic phase on a broad temperature interval. In principle, you should actually limit your attention between these two critical temperatures here. And at this point, actually, came also our motivation, and also for many others, to look into the most simple iron-based superconductor, iron-selenium, because in this compound, you simply have a structural, you just have a structural tetragonal to orthorhombic phase transition at 90 degree Kelvin without any subsequent phase transition into a magnetically ordered state. Upon further lowering the temperature, the materials get eventually superconducting below 10 Kelvin itself. So it certainly provides a playground, an arena, in order to look to the nematic phase and its impact over a very broad temperature interval without the complications due to the reconstruction of the Fermi surface because of the magnetically ordered state. And this was, in fact, our motivation. We did perform a lot of optical experiment on the cobalt 122 materials, which probably are known from the literature and I will briefly flash upon later on as comparison. But we wanted, in fact, to apply our experimental tool, which I will describe in a second, also on iron selenium in order to look for the impact of nematicity from the perspective of the electrodynamic response, of the charge dynamics, and also to look whether there are evidence in the optical properties for so-called nematic fluctuations. Now, let me point out an issue which is eventually important from an experimental point of view. It's also well known that any ferroelastic type of transition tends to induce the formation of dense structural twin. So in order to appreciate the anticipated anisotropy in any measurable physical quantity, you should make sure that you are looking to single domain fully detwin spacemen. Now, it has been shown for these materials that is a very large magnetic field, which are not so suitable for an optical experiment, and particularly razor moderate uniaxial stress or strain, are just enough in order to induce a detwinning of the space. And in fact, we developed a mechanical device which allows us to apply in situ and in a controlled way uniaxial stress. We are basically squeezing the spacemen mechanically with a clamp, but we can do that in situ, controlling the degree of detwinning and therefore also exploiting uniaxial stress as an external asymmetry breaking field. Typical sample which are nowadays available, very high quality, with very flat and shiny surface, very suitable for optical experiment, is shown here. The edge here corresponds to the tetragonal axis, and then you can realize, or you can prove that if you apply uniaxial stress, for instance, by squeezing your spacemen on the lateral face, then the shorter orthorhombic B-axis preferentially orient along the direction where stress is applied, and orthogonal to it, you have the orthorhombic elongated A-axis. Now, the experiment which we perform consists in measuring, first of all, the optical reflectivity. It's a very simple experiment. You shine light on the materials, on the surface, and you look whatever is reflected back, within the notion that what is reflected back contains the information about the intrinsic absorption spectrum of the investigated materials. We can perform this measurement with light polarized along different crystallographic direction, and in our experiment, as a function of two tunable variables, temperature, because of the structural and eventually the magnetic phase transition when this is present, and as I said, as a function of uniaxial stress, which we can control tune in situ. Now, I would like, first of all, to focus the attention on the measured quantity to try to show you what can be extracted already just from the measurement as it comes out from the spectrometer. But later on in my talk, I will show you that measuring the optical reflectivity over a broad spectral range, which extend in our experiment from the far infrared all the way up to the ultraviolet on a continuum of frequencies, you can then perform a reliable Kramer-Schulin transformation from where you get all optical function of the investigated materials, and I will focus my attention on the optical conductivity.
Sorry, what frequency range is
the... As I said, from the far infrared, which, let's say, millielectron volt, all the way up to the ultraviolet. Okay, so we cover somehow 4 to 5 decades in photon energy, and this on a continuum of frequencies. And as I said, it's a function of temperature and uniaxial stress, and obviously light it can be polarized along different crystallographic directions. So let me give you a flavor of the experimental results. As I said, first of all, as far as the measured quantity is concerned, here as an example for this experimental condition, before going any further, let me eventually say something about the applied stress. You will see overall in my talk that the stress is given in bar, so just as information, when you have a quantity of stress defined as 1 bar, it means that the stress effectively felt by your spaceman is of the order of 10 megapascal, just to give you an idea. So basically, you have to multiply that quantity with a factor which takes into account the geometry of the spaceman within your within our mechanical device to apply uniaxial stress. So 1 bar is usually, for this typical sample, 10 megapascal as stress effectively felt by the spaceman. And this, by the way, is the amount of stress which you need to fully detween your spaceman so that you are really sure that you are in a single domain phase. So what you see that the reflectivity is metallic-like in the sense that you have a kind of plasma edge feature, and then the reflectivity goes towards total reflection for frequency going towards you. This is a typical signature for a metallic behavior. Now, if you do a blow up of that spectral range shown here, basically focusing the attention in the mid-infrared down somehow to the onset of the far infrared spectral range, which I will discuss later on, you do see that there's an important polarization dependence of the measured reflectivity. It means that you have an optical anisotropy. And you see here that there are, in this experimental condition, so at low temperature, basically for a fully detweened spaceman, we recognize that there are 2 spectral ranges, which will be emphasized later on, where the polarization dependence is even reversed in sign. You have a switch of sign in the anisotropy itself. And then what I will show later on, if you move even down to the far infrared, we will see that there will be a further switch of the polarization dependence, and this is going to be then consistent also with what you expect in the DC limit looking to the anisotropy in the transport properties. But I will come back about that. So now I would like just to show you how this anisotropy developed in our experiment. So in order to emphasize the optical anisotropy, I will define this quantity, delta reflectivity ratio, which is defined as the reflectivity along the A-axis over the reflectivity along the B-axis, which amplify the polarization dependence. And I'm looking to the deviation with respect to 1 of this ratio, which is an indication 1 corresponds to the isotropic situation. And I'm going to show you that quantity as a measurement for the optical anisotropy. For the time being, just at 3 selected temperature, the structural phase transition is at 90 degree Kelvin. And I'm going to show you data collected after the zero stress cooling protocols. It means that we reach this target temperature without applying any kind of stress. And then at that fixed temperature, we did a stress loop experiment, increasing stress and then releasing it back to zero. And in situ, as I said, and in a controlled way. So if you do that at 10 Kelvin, well, you see that you have a progressive enhancement of this optical anisotropy given by that quantity, and this in both spectral ranges, which are peaked around 1,000 wave number and 3,000 wave number, so 100 and 300 millielectron volt, roughly. And you see, in fact, as I said before, that the anisotropy has opposite sign in the two distinct energy interval. At some point, you reach a kind of saturation in the optical anisotropy, and when you release stress back to zero, then you get something which somehow persists. I mean, the anisotropy just slightly decreases, but somehow persists by releasing stress from the spaceman. So you can repeat this experiment at different temperature, going closer to the structural transition. You have a similar effect, but less pronounced, and this effect totally disappears basically when you go above the structural phase transition, where is indeed totally gone. Now, in order somehow to show you in a more comprehensive way this data, what I would like to show you for this type of experiment after the zero pressure or stress cooling protocols, I would like to show you at more temperature the evolution of this optical anisotropy read at these fixed frequencies, where we have a peak, a strong enhancement in the anisotropy itself, as a function of stress itself. And this is shown here for both energy scale, and as you could imagine, already looking to this behavior, you have a hysteretic-like behavior. This at both energy scale, obviously with a different sign, as I pointed out before, but the two hysteretic behavior looks pretty similar also in magnitude. So by at this low temperature, when you start to apply stress, you have a razor sharp onset of this initial curve, and then it tends to saturate. We believe that this is the anisotropy when the spaceman is fully detuned in a single domain phase. And then when you release the stress back to zero, you are looking somehow to the remanent state from this perspective. Namely, you are considered or taking into account the imbalance of the two possible twin directions, which obviously remain frozen in place at that low temperature. And what you can measure here at zero release stress is somehow the intrinsic anisotropy, so to say, of the fully detwined but stress-free material. Now, that hysteretic behavior, we believe, is due to the domain wall motion of these twins, which turns out to be thermally activated, because when you increase, you repeat the experiment at different temperature, here just a few examples, that hysteretic behavior is progressively squeezed and quenched, and it disappears exactly at the structure phase transition itself. Now, what we can immediately say, looking to this spectrum, that there's an important impact of the structural phase transition in these materials over an energy interval of about alpha electron volt. I show you that the data are anisotropic all the way to 5,000 wave numbers, which are 500 millielectron volt, roughly speaking. Above that energy range, we didn't observe any temperature as well as stress dependence of the optical anisotropy. This is also consistent with what you get from ARPES, where most of the action somehow occurs within alpha electron volt, very close to the Fermi level, where you can identify the presence of these squeezed iron 3D bands, which is also an indication for the important role played by the electronic correlation in these materials. Now, let's go back to this hysteretic behavior, and let me show you now the temperature dependence, basically, of the optical anisotropy just at saturation, so for the fully detwined spaceman. I would like eventually also to tell you that we can also perform another kind of experiment after the so-called stress cooling protocol, so we can apply stress at very high temperature above the structural phase transition, and keeping spaceman under stress, we can go down to very low temperature, and then at that constant stress, we can measure as a function of temperature, we get actually the same results at saturation, so for the fully detwined spaceman. So the two procedures are fully equivalent. Now, let's give a look to the temperature dependence of this optical anisotropy at saturation, which is shown here with the temperature scale normalized by 90 degrees, the crystallographic tetragon-2-orthorhombic phase transition temperature. This for both energy scale. I also normalized that quantity describing the anisotropy by the value at very low temperature. And what you see here is that for both energy scale, although the sign is a switch, indeed you have a similar behavior. And all these points gather around this curve, which correspond to the temperature dependence of a mean field order-like parameter a la BCS. So you have a flat behavior where somehow the anisotropy tends to saturate, and then a sharp drop, or the other way around, coming from high temperature, a sharp onset of the optical anisotropy at the structural phase transition. We were not able for iron selenium to find any indication besides a weak negative or switch of sign at this lower energy scale for any anisotropy at higher temperature. So we can probably say that indeed this optical anisotropy, which we measure deep into the electronic structure at finite frequency, is somehow also representative for the order parameter of the structural phase transition itself. And I would like also to mention that these anisotropies that you achieve at low temperature persist and remain constant even at temperature below TC, so in the superconducting state. There's no change at all in the optical anisotropy.
So the red signal, though, is non-zero at the structural transition point.
Okay. Yes, I mean
it's
yeah. But I would say, I mean, this is somehow one single experiment. It fluctuates somehow around here. So I would say it's within, let's say, the experimental error.
So what roughly is the 0.5? T structural heuristic to be 90 degrees?
This is 90 degrees, exactly.
Oh, so then the where it's going to zero is actually,
yeah,
90 plus 45.
Okay, it could change a little bit. The critical temperature could change, obviously, a little bit, but I don't expect that at this small applied stress, which are so moderate, there will be such a large. So I took simply the transition temperature that you get from transport or any other measurement. So it was around 90 degrees. And here you have, I would say, from our point of view, taking into account the the resolution of our experiment and the way we can define this quantity, for us it's a quite sharp onset. I'm showing you now, I'm showing you now the comparison with our early measurement on the 1-2-2 materials, and there you will realize what I mean for sharp onset. Okay, just give me a second. Yeah, Andre.
You showed us two frequencies. Both are pretty high, 100 MeV, another 300 MeV. What do you see at lower frequencies?
What is it?
What you see at lower frequencies?
Oh, I will come back. I will come back to the low frequency part when we go to the far infrared, and where I would like to discuss the frequency to zero limit and approaching the DC conductivity. I'm coming back to that. So to go back to your questions, if we do a comparison in the same way for data which we got earlier on the cobalt 1-2 materials, then you have certainly, as you see here, a much and well-defined broad temperature dependence crossing the structural phase transition from high to low temperature of this quantity. And this, we were not able to see any signature of it in these materials. Now, interestingly enough, this broad temperature dependence in crossing the structural phase transition in the 1-2 materials turns out to be very similar to the anisotropes that you measure at DC with the transport properties for fully detuned spacemen. And it's also very similar to the stress-induced orthorhombicity that you can measure for these materials at stress which are equivalent to those which we have applied in order to detune the spacemen. You see, you have exactly or more or less the same type of behavior. Now, for iron selenium, you also see a broad tail in the DC anisotropy, and you can estimate, because I didn't find in the literature direct measurement of the stress-induced orthorhombicity in iron selenium, but you can, with elastic constant, estimate this quantity, and you get value which also are very close in this color-shaded area to what you get also for the 1-2 material. So, in our opinion, it means that although the DC anisotropy and the stress-induced orthorhombicity, even in the tetragonal phase, on both materials looks very much the same, it's quite similar, in our opinion, the anisotropy in the optical properties is quite different. You have in the 1-2 material such a broad crossover and somehow more sharper onset in the iron selenium compound. And we believe that this could be a signature for the fact that the induced orthorhombicity in the tetragonal phase does not couple in a simple or obvious way to the electronic structure in these materials. There's also another set of data which was which appeared in CONMAT on the server recently for a dynamic elastoresistive measurement by the Ames group. They also show that you can enhance that nematic susceptibility in a dynamic way. And the explanation for that is that in 1-2 materials particularly, you have topological defects due to dislocation, which can stabilize the fluctuating domain, and this may lead to a substantial pneumatic order and stress-induced orthorhombicity even at higher temperature. That would be absent in these materials, which are supposed to be very pure and quite disorder-free.
Yeah. Since you started talking about this, you surely know about Raman data for iron selenium.
Yeah.
There are two groups now claiming that they have data, and they both show substantial pneumatic susceptibility below 300 Kelvin and all the way up to, which supposedly on the surface is not consistent with this.
Exactly. So we don't have such a clear signature of this. I mean, you could relate that, and in fact we did in the past, this broad behavior to the pneumatic susceptibility as well. But it's not so clear in the iron selenium compound. It's absolutely not.
They have different frequency scales.
Probably they are different frequency scale, yes. Yeah. And in fact, probably if you go to much lower frequency, and you will see when you go toward the DC limit there, you will have signature of that. Mm-hmm.
Do you have more points at higher temperature? I mean, because that's just one.
Yeah, no, we have more points, and there basically we were not able to follow up. In this normalized scale, they fall outside there, but was basically flat. There was nothing at all. For sure, I mean, from the fact that, however, we have an optical anisotropy at this finite energy scale indicate that there must be an important anisotropy in the underlying electronic structure. And this, in fact, could be consistent also with the idea that the superconductivity developed within an electronically polarized state, because as I told you, that anisotropy persists even down to much lower temperature, well below the critical temperature for the superconducting state. In principle, when you have this type of optical anisotropy, you might think to an orbital ordering type of scenario as a driving mechanism for the structural phase transition. This could be consistent with a conclusion drawn from NMR experiment, for instance, but it would not be supported by recent ARPES data collected particularly on iron selenium. In fact, within an orbital ordering type of scenario, you consider or you imply a momentum-independent parallel shift of the splitted bands in the Brillouin zone,
but and that's only for ferroorbital ordering.
Yeah,
but there are, most people are talking about anti-ferroorbital ordering.
Okay, well,
go ahead.
Okay, yeah, but this would be the simple way to see this type of
right. They just give you different sign of pneumatic order on hole and electron pockets. That's it.
Yeah. Okay, but this is somehow what you might simply expect, but this is not supported by the ARPES investigation, which indicate that there's a quite complex and intricate evolution of the electronic structure, particularly between the gamma and the endpoint of the Brillouin zone. And there are several proposals. I mean, there are so many ARPES data in the literature, everyone has a different interpretation. They are anyhow all consistent with the fact that one has to go beyond a simple ferroorbital ordering type of scenario. There are proposals, for instance, from this nice experiment by Watson and co-worker. They actually perform an experiment in a similar way as we did our optical experiment, so by squeezing the spacemen, so with materials which are fully detuned. And they were, in fact, able to point out that there's a kind of bond type of ordering. You have this peanut shape like Fermi surface, which are oriented in a well-defined direction. They pick up a well-defined direction, and when you go above the structural transition, you have basically the projection of both. Or as it was also proposed by Shen group at Stanford, you may introduce a momentum-dependent shift of the corresponding splitted orbitals. This could be due to an orbital selective renormalization of the various bands, and the proposal was that this introduce or induce a band shift reversion, and this could be in fact consistent also with the fact that in our optical experiment in different distinct energy interval we do observe an optical anisotropy which even switch aside.
Yeah. Sorry to interrupt
for a second. Sure, no
problem. All these interpretation experiments are talking about much smaller frequencies that you are talking about, right? The amount of long-range order extracted from ARPES out of pneumatic order is about 20 MeV. That's what people extracted, both this group and Borisenko
sure.
extracted gamma point.
Sure.
So we're talking at energies 20, 30 MeV.
Sure, but this can have an impact directly on the electronic structure and deep into the electronic structure that we do see with our experiment.
Your energies are 10 times larger.
Well, but as I showed you before, I don't know if I can go back quickly. Okay, here, you see, we have also in our experiment an optical anisotropy which extends about half electron volt. And this is exactly the range where you have this squeezed 3D electron band. So these are the materials, the orbital which are affected by the structural phase transition. And this is exactly what we see with our experiment.
Okay. Not sure, but...
Okay. Now, independent of what is the interpretation for this optical anisotropy, it's obvious that there's an anisotropy in the underlying electronic structure. But the question is, in fact, how this affect much smaller energy scale when you approach the DC limit, which is then relevant for the transport properties. And this question is relevant because it fits within a debate as to whether the DC anisotropy, which is also observed and measured experimentally, is due to an anisotropy in the scattering rate of the thinner uncharged covers, as it seems to be suggested by STM type of results with the presence of these nematogens, which in fact induce a direction-dependent anisotropic scattering in these materials, or is possibly the consequence of anisotropy in the Fermi surface parameter. As it seems to be indicated by elastoresistive type of measurement, where indeed the pneumatic susceptibility was found to be independent of disorder, and this for a broad range, a wide range of impurity and defects concentration. Now, the experiment that you wish to perform in order to shed light on this debate is an experiment which gives you access to both parameters which determine transport, the scattering rate as well as the Fermi surface parameters, the charge current concentration and the effective mass. And this is indeed in principle possible with an optical experiment, because from an optical experiment, as I'm going to show you later on, you can extract the scattering rate of the thinner uncharged carriers as well as the plasma frequency. The plasma frequency square is proportional to the Drude weight, which is a quantity given by the ratio of the charge current concentration over the effective mass. So you have access to Fermi surface parameters. Now, in order to somehow show you how this is possible, in a phenomenological way at least, I would like now to introduce you in the real part of the optical conductivity. It's a razor suitable quantity, because as you are going to see later on, in order to extract these parameters, you have to make some assumption, and the various components which contribute to the complete excitation spectrum are in this quantity additive and therefore easy to understand. So let me show you the real part of the optical conductivity, first of all on a broad energy interval for the iron selenium, and here I just limit the attention on the results at saturation, so it means for an applied stress for which we believe the spacemen is in a fully detuned single domain phase, or for which we did observe a saturation in the optical anisotropy. I would like also to use this representation in order to convey you that what I said before as far as the measured quantity is concerned is fully imaged also here in the real part of the optical conductivity. First of all, you see this razor narrow sharp onset of the effect metallic contribution of the Drude resonance, which I will show you later on an expanded scale. And then at finite frequency, you observe that there are two clearly observed energy interval where the anisotropy is switched inside. Now, a comparison with the 1 to 2 materials tells you that in this spectral range, the two materials are pretty similar, they have similar type of features, although for these materials the optical anisotropy was observed at much lower frequency, so below about 2000 wave numbers, and the sign of the anisotropy was actually the same in that spectral range with the equivalent spectral interval as for the iron selenium compound. So let me now show you what happened when you push down to the far infrared, so to smaller energy scale, when you approach the DC limit of the optical conductivity, which allows you establishing a link with the DC transport property. This is shown here for both compound. And don't be bothered by the spikes, which are due to the phonon modes, which are not relevant for today's discussion. So what you see here at saturation, so for a fully detuned spacement, that in an iron selenium, indeed the optical conductivity along the orthorhombic axis is yet slightly, but always consistently higher, or somehow slightly higher than along the orthorhombic A axis. And the opposite is true for the 1 to 2 materials. Please take into account the anisotropy at DC in these materials is much smaller than in the 1 to 2 material. This also explains the clear resolution of the anisotropy for these materials as well. This is consistent, by the way, with what you get in the DC limit. In fact, the anisotropy at DC is such that along the orthorhombic A axis, which is also the antiferromagnetic axis for the 1 to 2 materials, the conductivity should be higher than along the shorter orthorhombic ferromagnetic B axis. And this is typical for electron dot materials, while iron selenium is supposed to belong to the group of materials like the whole doped system with a reverse type of anisotropy, and this is indeed what we do observe experimentally. Now, when you have the optical conductivity, you can then try to extract the quantity I was mentioning before. A common tool in optics can be to use or to exploit the phenomenological Lorentz-Drude model to describe all optical function, including the directly measured quantity, the optical reflectivity indeed. But in the real part of the optical conductivity, the various components that we can use for our optical, for the phenomenological description of the optical response are indeed additives. It has been widely shown by several groups, by now, not only by ourselves, that the optical conductivity in these iron-based superconductors is nicely reproduced when you are considering two Drude terms for the effective metallic contribution to the optical conductivity. There's a narrow and a broad one. And these account for the multiband nature in this system and indicate that there are eventually two electronic subsystems here. And then you have a series of Lorentz harmonic oscillators for the finite frequency excitation. Obviously, I will not bother you today with technicalities about the fitting procedures. I will be glad to do so in private discussion. But I like to insist on the fact that within this fitting philosophy, which by the way is identical for both crystallographic direction, you can reproduce in great details, as you see here as an example for the real part of the optical conductivity, all optical function, including the measured quantity. And this as a function of both tunable variables, temperature and uniaxial stress, which are two tunable parameters in our experiment. Now, the motivation today is to to exploit this tool in order to extract systematically the parameters which are relevant for the transport properties. And I would like to establish the link between the obvious anisotropy in the charge dynamics and what is measured at DC. So I will just focus the attention on the Drude parameters, which are the Drude weights, so which correspond to the color shaded areas, to the integral of the Drude resonance, and the width at half maximum, which is the measurement of the scattering rate of the Tinnerant charge colors. I will show you, first of all, the anisotropy of these parameters of the so-called total Drude weight, namely the spectral weight encountering the effective metallic contribution to the optical conductivity, which in our approach is simply given by the sum of this square plasma frequency. And then I will discuss also the scattering rate for both the narrow and the broad Drude component. And I will focus the attention only on the parameters at saturation, so for fully detuned spacemen in a single domain phase. And I would like to emphasize the anisotropy, which is then defined as the ratio of this quantity between the different crystallographic directions. Maybe just let me draw your attention on the fact that because of the Drude model, resistivity is directly proportional to the scattering rate. So I'm using the ratio A over B, but it's inverse proportional to the Drude weight. So for the Drude weight, I'm using the B over A. Now, what I'm also showing you here as comparison is the measured DC anisotropy, measured effectively by an experiment with transport technique, rho A over rho B. So what we see is that there's an obvious anisotropy in the Drude weight, which would call for the important role of the anisotropy in the Fermi surface parameters. But there's also an important non-negligible anisotropy in the scattering rate of the narrow as well of the broad Drude component. We also observe that this anisotropy, or let's say the relationship, the link with the DC anisotropy in the transport property is not that obvious or immediate indeed. Nonetheless, when you extract from the optical conductivity the Drude weight and the scattering rate, you can reconstruct the DC limit of the optical conductivity. And then you can compare this with the measured quantity with transport technique. And this is a self-consistency check. You see that these anisotropic Drude parameters are important in order to describe the anisotropy measured in the charge dynamics, so in the optical conductivity. But they can consistently reproduce the anisotropy that is measured also with the with transport technique, so at DC, basically in the static limit at frequency zero. Now, since I'm running out of time, let me skip a few slides. Okay. And just try to establish, approaching the conclusion of my talk, I would like to establish the link between these parameters, which are necessary in order to describe the anisotropy in the charge dynamic. There's an obvious interplay in the anisotropy of Drude weight and scattering rate, to establish a link with the DC anisotropy itself. And I would like, in fact, to start from the measured quantity by the Ames group. You see, in fact, what I was anticipating before, that you have this tail in the anisotropy already in the tetragonal phase. These measurements were performed by applying strain on the spacemen, and you have, for sample under strain, an obvious anisotropy in the transport. If you define the anisotropy as the difference between the two, you can then, with some elaboration of the data, also calculate the DC anisotropy for a fully detuned but stress-free material. And this is also shown here. You have this dome-like temperature dependence of the DC anisotropy, which peaks about 20 degrees below the structural transition. And the proposal here was to explain this quite peculiar dome-like temperature dependence in the DC anisotropy by the convolution of two functions, an ordered parameter-like function because of the nematic phase transition, and then by an additional function having this shape. And in fact, the proposal was to consider the average DC resistivity between the two crystallographic axes as a proxy for this temperature dependence. And if you multiply that function with this function, you can then recover pretty nicely the DC anisotropy and its temperature dependence. And this, yes?
Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, no problem.
Is there any simple explanation of why?
Yeah, I mean, this, yeah, this was a model. This was model taking into account scattering by anisotropic spin fluctuation.
If we take this, go to even previous stage, is there any understanding why order parameter should go to zero at zero temperature?
No, it's not.
No, it doesn't go to zero temperature. This is the order. I mean, that the blue curve is given by this quantity multiplied by that.
So what goes to zero?
Scattering rate.
That goes to zero. So which is the anisotropy? Obviously, here pay attention. You have the phase transition into the superconducting state. I don't think that you can define that.
Right, but
this dome-like behavior, this is just the DC anisotropy for a fully detuned but stress-free material. And you get this by multiplying the order parameter with a function here. Which?
Why gamma goes to zero?
Rho goes to zero.
Sorry?
Rho goes to zero.
What do you mean,
yeah,
gamma?
But still, then the anisotropy is a ratio, is it?
No, well, it depends how you define it. I defined it as a ratio, but here it was just defined as a difference between
it's
the two.
It's a difference, not a ratio.
I see, so zero minus zero is zero.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. Because here you see the anisotropy disappears, so basically you go to zero, and it disappears here, so you go to zero. And the largest anisotropy is somehow 20 degrees below the structural phase transition, if you define as a difference. Okay. Now, it's not my goal here to defend or support this interpretation. I just want to tell you what can you find in the literature, and somehow what is a possible explanation for this peculiar behavior. Now, my conclusion, eventually in a somehow more provocative way, is to tell you, or to try to convey you, that in fact these two ingredients, which were proposed here in order to describe the anisotropy at DC, can be directly evinced in the same experiment, optical experiment, which we have performed. I try to convey you, in fact, that if you look to the optical anisotropy at finite energy scale, so for us deep into the electronic structure, we have an anisotropy which follow pretty closely the temperature dependence of an order parameter. So this would be the first component that you need. And then we can also extract, when we look to the low frequency part of our optical conductivity, the temperature dependence of the anisotropic through the parameters. This is shown here for the scattering rate of the broad Rudder component. And we see that the temperature dependence, in fact, comes pretty close to this so-called DC resistivity. Again, this is the average DC resistivity measure between the two crystallographic axes, what was used in the theoretical approach as a proxy for this temperature-dependent function due eventually to scattering by anisotropic spin fluctuation. Yes?
So I didn't catch what the first thing that had the temperature dependence, yeah, like an order parameter.
All right.
What was that?
I show you right at the beginning when we were looking just to the reflectivity that at finite frequency you have two distinct energy intervals where you have an anisotropy in the optical reflectivity, which I define as deviation with respect to one. It's that one. Okay. So, and basically this was the discussion even before why we don't see a tail here. So I show you that anisotropy has a sharp onset at the structural phase transition, which follow this order parameter light temperature dependence. So this would be the first ingredient for us. Yeah.
And the second was the ratio of the scattering rate.
Okay, then let's go back. Then we can also extract this through the parameter. So we can extract the temperature dependence of the anisotropic through the parameter. Here, first of all, the scattering rate for the broad through the component for the two crystallographic axes, the A and the B axis, blue and red. And all quantity here are normalized at 100 Kelvin. So this is not the ratio. This is just this row. B axis, A axis, and this is just normalized at 100 Kelvin, just for the...
So both go down, but if you take the ratio of the two, does it...
Then you have this kind of, you see here, you have then this kind of peaks, what I showed you before. Here. So if you take the ratio, you have these broad peaks. But then when you plot the temperature dependence of the single scattering rate for the A and the B orthorhombic axis, which is an isotropic, because otherwise you would not have the peak, then you, then you get this one. Okay, and this, I just normalized all quantity at 100 degree Kelvin, and for comparison, I'm showing you again this this average DC resistivity between the two crystallography axes. So you see that the temperature dependence completely close to the DC resistivity, similarly but not so pronounced for the narrow Drude component, but when you look to the Drude weight, again you see that there's an anisotropy, slightly temperature dependent, but the temperature dependence here of this parameter is less pronounced with respect to what you get at DC. So basically, although all these Drude parameters and their anisotropic is important, and I'm finishing, is important in describing the anisotropy in the charge dynamics, then when it comes to the DC limit, it seems that the major role is actually played by the scattering rate itself. This would be consistent with this approach that I mentioned before, that in fact the scattering by anisotropic spin fluctuation might play the major role, might be the dominant mechanism in these materials. Okay, this was somehow the provocative conclusion of our present stage of our work on iron selenium. Allow me to acknowledge the great work of my team, particularly of my PhD student and my postdoc, the beautiful spacemen by the Ames group and from Stanford, and the important theoretical support by various people, particularly at Minnesota. And last but not least, the great financial support of a few agencies in Switzerland. Thank you very much for your kind attention. And this is actually the main building of physics in the campus outside the town where we work. All right.
Questions?
Andre made a comment which I didn't understand. Can I ask him?
Yeah.
Anti-ferro quadrupolar order, doesn't that not break C4 symmetry macroscopically?
No. It's much simpler. If you have D-wave charge order parameter, which by definition breaks C4 symmetry, it's generally a function of center of mass momentum.
No, but then it preserves, then it preserves 90-degree rotation followed by...
It still has cosine kx minus cosine ky form, but it has also function of modulus of k.
I think the simplest way to say it is the bond-centered dynamic.
Yeah, this is important, but even more simple, if we just look at the order parameter, D-wave order parameter, we can define it on hole pockets, we can define it on an electron pockets, right?
Okay.
There are two order parameters.
Yes.
The relative sign between two order parameters is not guaranteed.
So that's not what I would call anti-ferro quadrupolar.
I also don't like this wording, but it's just opposite to ferro.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's just different sign of order parameter on hole and electron pockets, no more than that.
Normally it would have meant that there was a product that was preserved of translation, that both translation symmetry and rotation symmetry were broken, but some product was conserved.
This is not what...
Okay.
It's just a novel literature. Any other questions? So your main conclusion, let me just...
Is that Jorge Hirsch in the window up there?
So the main thing that you're trying to say about is that the transfer in isotropy seems to be actually dominated by scattering rate in an isotropy. That's what you would like to say?
This would be one conclusion, yeah. At least at this stage of our investigation, looking to the comparison, or let's say, when we try to establish a link between the anisotropy at finite frequency, the optical conductivity down to the far infrared, towards the DC limit, yes.
And the way you are extracting information about the scattering rate is through modeling the optical conductivity.
Exactly. And this is a pretty common standard way to do that, yes. It's just a phenomenological way. However, I had a few view graphs, but I had no time. I should warn that one has to pay attention what is exactly the meaning of the parameters that we extract from optics with respect to transport. There's a beautiful work by Rafael Fernandez's group and Michael Schutt pointing out that what we actually extract from the optical conductivity is a kind of effective through the weight and scattering rate, which might not necessarily coincide with the scattering rate that you get from transport, because you have to take into account that you have also a third important parameter, which is somehow neglected quite often, namely the renormalization of the optical mass enhancement, which is possibly due to the renormalization of the Fermi velocity because of spin fluctuation. And this is an important issue, but this can be discussed probably privately in a more careful way, yeah.
May I bring you back to the issue about relation to ARPES?
Relation to ARPES.
Okay, yes.
There is some interesting point about this, but just to understand, so you showed up data at 300 MeV and at 100 MeV. When ARPES people normally try to extract all pneumatic order from their data, they look at gamma points, they look at M point, they're always talking about energy about 20-30 MeV.
Yes.
And the measure of the pneumatic order parameter, which, say, Parisienko extracted and also Malek-Aldey extracted, is about 20 MeV. Now, are you saying that there are other bands which exist, which lay somewhere around half a volt or 300 MeV below Fermi level, where you also feel, the system also feels pneumatic order?
Well, I mean, it's clear from this experiment that at least within alpha electron volt from the Fermi level, we do observe a clear anisotropy in the electronic structure. That is what but obviously what we measure are energy which correspond to transition between occupied and unoccupied state, right? So then it could well be that depending how the band structure is, that a splitting of 20 or 50 millielectron volt at the level of this orbital can give rise to anisotropy at much larger frequencies, right? Depending on how is the transition. But for sure, independent of that, what we see is that there's an impact of the anisotropy related to the pneumatic phase, because we are showing the evolution of that by applying an external symmetry breaking field, by applying uniaxial stress, or by progressively detwining the spacemen. So within alpha electron volt of the...
If I understood the character, this is peculiar for iron selenium.
Yes, because for the 1-2 materials, we were able to observe this type of anisotropy at much lower, somehow at energy scale which halves as much as for the below 2,000 wave number, so roughly 200 millielectron volt, yes.
All right. Thanks, Leonardo, again.
Thank you.